This is Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. When Julia Alvarez writes, her readers begin to gather around her in her mind. They sort of materialize in front of her as she creates.
A story comes to you. It's almost not a decision. And out of the situation in which it evolves in your head and intrigues you, comes a sense of its audience, or who is sitting in that first row of that circle that I always think of as a storyteller, that there's a circle, you know, that everybody can join.
That circle is an expansive one. Her readers span the globe as her popular novels have been translated into many languages. She gained critical acclaim in the 90s for her novels How the Garcia Girls Lost Their Accents, In the Time of the Butterflies, and Yo. Some of her more recent work has looked at the lives of migrant farm workers in Vermont. Yesterday, the White House announced that Alvarez is one of the recipients of the 2013 National Medal of Arts. She'll join the other recipients at a ceremony at the White House on Monday. But before she does, we wanted to have her on to reflect on her career so far. Julia Alvarez, welcome back to Vermont Edition.
Oh, Jane, thanks for having me again.
The National Medal of Arts is the government's highest award given to artists, and in it they say they give it to artists who, quote, are deserving of special recognition by reason of their outstanding contributions to the excellence, growth, support, and availability of the arts in the United States. That's a high bar to have to pass. Congratulations.
Well, thank you. I agree, and I think there's you're right. It sounds amazing, even to me. I couldn't quite believe it when I got the call. And of course, you know how many others are working as hard and contributing as much. So you also feel a little it's a little daunting to be the one, you know, to come forward when you know all of you are working at this together.
When did you get the call, and what was it like?
Well, I got it a few weeks ago, and it was from my agent, and I, you know, I said, "Are you kidding?" He said, "No, I'm not." And there was only one caveat, that I was not to say a word to anyone. I said, "Can I tell Bill,
my husband?"
and he said, "Yeah, you can tell him, and no one else, because the White House wants to be the one who." It, you know, once they announce it, then you can call everybody, but not before. So there was a sort of unreal feeling about it, because things really become real when shared, and valuable when shared. So it was kind of a limbo period. I would every once in a while remember and think, did I dream this up? And then, of course, yesterday the announcement was made, and and I've been hearing from a lot of dear people, old friends, family, people that I haven't heard from in a long while. So it does feel more real now, for sure.
Did you have to hold yourself up and not go to the local coffee shop, or not go to your usual haunts, because you were afraid you just wanted to spill this great news?
Well, no, it wasn't that hard for me to keep it to myself, because it gave me a chance to sort of catch my breath. And I think the best things with these things are, yes, to enjoy them for all of us, because, as I say, I've told many friends this, you know, by this time in life, you know that no one gets to be who they are if they have any measure of, you know, feeling some achievement or success without knowing that, you know, you became who you are through the investment of so many people. So there's a sense of all of us, all of these people I carry with me going forward. So, you know, it just it gave me a chance to sort of catch my breath and get, you know, geared up for this. But I think the best thing with these things are to enjoy them for what they are, and then to roll up your sleeves and like William Lang says, time to get back to work.
Well, you know, on that, in announcing the award and your name as a recipient, the White House says you're being recognized for extraordinary storytelling and goes on to say that in poetry and prose, you explore themes of identity, family, and cultural divides. It says, quote, Alvarez illustrates the complexity of navigating two worlds and reveals the human capacity for strength in the face of opposition. And I'm curious if an award like this that is such visible recognition, how you use that, or if you think about ways to use it to highlight your work or ideas or projects that you are working on.
Absolutely. I think if you do manage to get the ear of the Sultan, and I'm going back to the Scheherazade story of Arabian Nights, you use it to, you know, to change things that you see need changing. The problem is that as you get some visibility, there's so much and so many needs come forward. And then you have the very tricky situation, which I don't enjoy, of having to decide. But absolutely, it's what a professor once said to me when I was, you know, feeling so grateful for the help that he had given me. He said, I said, I don't know how to repay you. And he says, you don't repay these things, you pass them on. So definitely, you know, ways in which we can use whatever power we have and credibility we have to get things to change. I'm thinking very much right now of work we're doing in the Dominican Republic because of the very troubled situation between the two nations on a small island, Haiti and the Dominican Republic. And, you know, a group of us gather every October on the anniversary of a massacre that happened there in 1937. And we call ourselves Border of Lights. And for those days in which the massacre took place, we light up the border with candles at night, song, poetry, storytelling, projects during the day collaboratively between the two nations. And part of what happens is that, you know, when I'm asked to do interviews like this, I talk about Border of Light. So things like that. And then the more quiet work you do of helping people, young writers get started, things that need doing in a community, all of that stuff. So, yeah, that's if it's for anything, it's for that.
We're talking today with author Julia Alvarez about her life and work and the announcement that she's a recipient of the Medal of Arts Award given out at the White House. That is going to be given out on Monday. And listeners, many of you have read her novels, her poetry. You followed her work on literacy in the Dominican Republic and other projects that she's working on. If you have a question for her, you can call 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. Or tell us about what you've read and what you've appreciated about it. You can post that on the Vermont Edition page at vpr.net. Julia, maybe you could talk a little bit more about your work with Border of Lights and help explain the Parsley Massacre, as it's known, from 1937. And could you start by explaining why it's called that?
Well, there's a very wonderful Rita Dove, who was our poet laureate, a poem called Parsley. And because this massacre that happened in the Dominican Republic was kept by the dictatorship out of our books, I really found out about it from coming to this country and reading things like Rita Dove's poem Parsley. And in 1937, by order of Trujillo, our dictator, all of these Haitians and Dominicans of Haitian descent who were living on the Dominican side of the border were massacred in the space of 10 days in October 1937. And it was a kind of genocide little known in the Americas that were soon very caught up in the genocide across the ocean in Europe. It's a massacre that never got really fully addressed or redressed by the authorities in the Dominican Republic, and very few people knew about it. So on the 75th anniversary, 2 years ago, now going on 3 years, actually, a group of us gathered at the border and did a commemoration and, as I said, some projects. So we decided that every year in October we would do this. And we hoped that it would be a kind of model in our own little way. We were one border of light, that maybe it could be a movement replicated in borders around the world where there are troubles, people themselves coming out from, you know, under, I mean, not waiting for governments and accords to be reached, but deciding to work together, and troubled communities. As you know, Jane, right here in Vermont, we have our own immigrant story. Many immigrants, actually, but the migrant workers who are upholding a lot of the dairy farms with their work. So anyhow, that's the origin of why it's called the Parsley Massacre.
Well, and just to double back, partly called the Parsley Massacre, I understand, because it was difficult to tell who was of Haitian descent and who was non-Haitian, more sort of original Dominican descent. And so one of the ways that that these sort of paramilitary people would tell is they would ask residents to say the word parsley in Spanish, perejil, and if they said it with a Creole accent, that sort of delineated them as of Haitian descent, and that was one of the ways to determine who to massacre. Do I have that right?
Oh, absolutely. Sorry, Jane. I sort of bypassed your question. That's exactly right. The Haitian, because he speaks Creole, would pronounce it perejil, would not trill the R, perejil. And this is how, the only way, really, that one word the soldiers of Trujillo would know that this person was of Haitian descent because of the pronunciation. And of course, you know, Haitians looking very much like Dominicans, because especially at the border, it was a very mixed community, would claim to be Dominicans because they didn't want to be massacred. So they would, this would be the way they would hold up the green sprig and say, and what is this?
But you're doing this work now. You're remembering this massacre of 1937, and every year going to the border to try to highlight, you know, one border, one people in a way. But I understand that you're also troubled by a recent court decision in the Dominican Republic that has echoes, perhaps somewhat less brutal and less violent, but certainly echoes of the Parsley Massacre, in that Dominicans of Haitian descent who were born in the Dominican Republic but are of Haitian parents, for example, are now considered stateless in a way. They're not being considered, in some cases, citizens of the Dominican Republic.
Absolutely. This just happened in September, right before we gathered in October at the border. And it was a very hot situation, as a matter of fact. We were not able to hold our usual vigil at the border. And the people involved, they're very tech savvy. The young people, we did a virtual vigil so that people could post a light, a candle online. But yes, this ruling had just been passed, virtually denationalizing anybody of born of parents. You know, before anybody born in the Dominican Republic was a Dominican citizen, but denationalizing those born of foreign parents, if they couldn't prove that their parents were documented legally in the country, and this was retroactive to 1929. So grandkids of people whose parents had been born in the Dominican Republic, who didn't know any Creole, who had never been to Haiti, who always considered themselves Dominican citizens, were suddenly stateless. And this is still ongoing. A huge protest has been mounted by many in the country and many of us outside the country. And this is being reconsidered, and a speeded up process is being cobbled together whereby these people can claim their citizenship. So shades of what is happening now with children entering the country, we're trying to speed up a way to send them back. But, you know, I think what we're seeing is what happens when you have a small planet and resources unevenly distributed and people in desperate straits. you know, we're going to have to rethink this idea of borders and who belongs where and how we can take care of each other on this little planet of, you know, quickly diminishing resources.
Those real-life events that you're talking about now are often manifested in your fiction work. You take those events and you write about them and you make characters who people can relate to out of things like these events. How do you see what you're doing now with activism translating into your writing?
Well, it's interesting you ask that because my last book, A Wedding in Haiti, is nonfiction. And part of it is trying to talk about these two little countries on an island. But instead of, you know, as I'm doing now, you know, voicing, you know, opinions or points of view through straightforward statement, doing it through story. Because story, what's wonderful about story is that you enter into the other point of view. You connect with what it feels like to be the other. And not resisting it because it's an opinion you might not agree with, you might feel, you know, put on the spot. Instead, you are relating to being that other being. And I, you know, this is the thing that has always called to me about storytelling, that it is a way to become the other. So in A Wedding in Haiti, I do that, but with a nonfiction story of something that happened to us with a young Haitian worker in the Dominican Republic. So I do see that part of my interest in writing nonfiction has to do with feeling that you know, that reality is stranger than fiction. Some of the things that are coming down that I need to address, but always, I think, through storytelling as a way of involving people in what a law or a ruling comes down to, which is how it affects individual people who are not that different from us.
We're talking today with author Julia Alvarez about some of the activism that she is involved in and her writing and her work. Listeners, if you've read her novels, her poetry, maybe you've read A Wedding in Haiti, a recent nonfiction book she wrote, or followed her work on literacy in the Dominican Republic, you can talk with her now. Call 1-800-639-2211 or post your thoughts on the Vermont Edition page at vpr.net. I'm Jane Lindholm, and this is Vermont Edition. We're speaking today with author Julia Alvarez. Her novels for adults and young readers have garnered critical acclaim, and for more than 25 years, she's been a writer in residence at Middlebury College, where she also spent her undergraduate years. On Monday, she'll be recognized for her work when she receives the National Medal of Arts at the White House. If you've read How the Garcia Girls Lost Their Accents or In the Time of the Butterflies or her young adult novels, including the Vermont story Return to Sender, let us know what you see in her writing. Call 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211 or post your thoughts on the Vermont Edition page at vpr.net. Just before the break, we were talking a little bit about how you use characters to help bring up themes that people might interact with in news stories or through personal opinion. But when you get into a character's heart and soul, you have a different understanding because there's a human experience. And right at the top of the program, I played a little clip from the last time you were on our show, and you were talking about how your audience sort of appears, how you think about the front row of your circle of readers appearing for you. And in some ways, you're writing towards that particular group of readers. When you have the spark of a story, though, are you writing for yourself, or are you always envisioning your readers? Is that the driver?
Well, I think it's both, Jane. I think that it's I'm definitely a storyteller. When I talk about that circle of storytelling, I'm definitely think of storytelling as a community. The story, the need for the story grows out of a situation that comes to you in your life and in your community. And I don't know if it was growing up in, you know, a Latino family where it was never just a me. It was always a we. And feeling that, in a sense, you tell the story both because it makes meaning out of your experience. But for me, a story is only completed when the second half happens, when someone receives it and it brings it to life within their imagination and it helps them to make meaning of their lives. So really, that's a circle that I need. I don't think I could just write for myself. Maybe keep a journal. But I definitely think of it as a something that happens in community, out of issues in community.
Let me ask you about that idea of community. Vermont certainly claims you. You've been here for a long time now, and you've worked at the college for a long time. You've been in the United States for most of your life, and we certainly think of you as, you know, part of the culture here, part of the community. But when you first settled in the United States at age 10, again, you were born here, but only lived in the States for 3 months before your family returned to the Dominican Republic. And you came back here when you were 10, and you weren't necessarily welcomed by everyone when you first came. There were a lot of bullies. There were a lot of racial epithets thrown your way. There was a lot of teasing because you didn't speak English very well. How do you square those ideas then when you think about being welcomed now and having acclaim and fame and having people claim you when you also can see that that wasn't always the case for you?
Well, that's very, very much a part of the heartwarming feeling that this brings. You know, one of the things that I thought, I wish my parents could still be alive. Because I know how much for them, you know, they were so worried that we would be accepted, that we wouldn't be sent back, that we would belong, that we had to prove that we were good enough. And so I feel like I wish they could be here for this moment. And I also, you know, feel heartwarmed because, you know, there's so much work still that remains to be done. And I was going on and on about, you know, what needs to be done, but also to recognize that some things have happened. I know that when we came, 1960, and that television was having, you know, the civil rights movement, people getting hosed down and arrested and dogs turned on them. And I thought, this is the land of freedom? And then we'd go to the school and the bullies would throw stones at us and spit us and told us to go back to where we came from. This was, you know, we had left a dictatorship and I knew that was horrible, but gosh, this wasn't a very welcoming place. But, you know, of course, I found reading, I found books, I found the great democracy of the imagination where everybody was welcome. So in a sense, you know, I did come to a new land, the land of reading, the land of storytelling. But now, you know, to think, my gosh, I am part of American literature. I'm going to the White House to get a medal from the first African-American president. I mean, how cool is that, you know? When I looked over the list of the other honorees and I saw Maxine Hong Kingston, oh my gosh, she was, when I read Woman Warrior in 1976 or 78 when it first came out, and this was the story of a Chinese-American girl in Sacramento, but she could have been my Dominican twin, the very same issues, and she is also going to be there with me. I mean, it just feels like, It's taken, you know, 50 years plus, but it's happened. You know, some small steps have happened in this ongoing work. So I feel very, very touched by that. Yes, that's a big part of it.
So there's no bitterness for you?
Oh, you know, that might have been not bitterness, but proving myself. Maybe that was part of the gasoline. But by the time you get to this point, that might have been what got you started, but it has to be a bigger circle. You know, one of the things I love about the Scheherazade story in the Arabian Nights is she not only saves herself with her storytelling, she saves all the women in her kingdom because the Sultan was murdering them out of hatred and misogyny, but her storytelling opened his imagination and his heart. So she also changed him. So that's important that, you know, bitterness is about us-ing and them-ing, continuing that paradigm. But when you use storytelling to really transform that part in yourself that is small and closed down and bitter, but also that part in other people, now that's what the work is about.
You mentioned Maxine Hong Kingston's work, A Woman Warrior. That was also one of my favorite books as a teenager, really eye-opening. And you've done a lot of writing for young adults and young people. And as I understand it, it was your own love of reading that drew you to writing. So you in your life have worked to encourage literacy and to work with young people on reading and writing and literacy. Why do you have that as such a strong focus?
Well, because, you know, when we got involved in this literacy project in the Dominican Republic, my husband, Bill Eichner, and myself, and, you know, we actually had gone down there and he had started a project with coffee farmers and getting them, you know, fair trade wages, you know, good pricing for their coffee that they were at that point selling at 33 cents a pound. So he was doing the agricultural part. And I was down there as the writer, kind of, you know, doing my writing. And I felt like a hanger-on, you know, what was my work here? And I keep talking about, you know, how literature is the great treasure house. It belongs to all of us. It's, you know, our legacy as part of the you know, human community. But there's that caveat that you need a key to open that chest, and that's literacy. That's reading and writing. And all around us in that community in the Dominican Republic, there were people who didn't know how to read or write. They knew a lot about the soil, but they couldn't read or write. And that's when I started to get interested, because the books, of course, that you teach reading with are very elementary, working, you know, for writing, for, as I call it, young people of all ages. And so, yeah, literacy is an important key in order to be able to access that transformative world of the imagination that's in print, especially as oral cultures begin, in many cases, to disappear.
Before we let you go, Julia, I just want to ask you very quickly. We got a note from Joe who tweeted to say, what a great conversation, and then wants to know how you think we could push for change in Vermont and around the country.
Well, I guess I would go back to storytelling. You know, one of the books that I had volunteers that went down to the Literacy Project read is Hope in the Dark, Untold Stories, Wild Possibilities by the wonderful writer and environmental activist Rebecca Soltnit. And she talks about how connecting people with stories can really begin to change and inspire them to, you know, to not just be changed, but to promote change. So I think storytelling and getting our stories out and sharing them is key for me.
Julia Alvarez will be honored with the National Medal of Arts at a ceremony at the White House on Monday. Among the other recipients are singer Linda Ronstadt, DreamWorks founder Jeffrey Katzenberg, and public radio host Diane Rehm. Julia Alvarez, felicitaciones y muchísimas gracias por visitándonos.
Oh, Jane, thank you so much. And thank you for the despedida en español, for the goodbye in Spanish.
Coming up, we'll speak with Officer Chris Morrell, who just retired from the Shelburne Police Department after a 41-year career in law enforcement. He leaves as the oldest serving police dog handler in the nation. We'll meet Morrell and his dog, Buck, next on Vermont Edition. Welcome back to Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. For many years, Chris Morrell was a member of the Hinesburg Volunteer Fire Department. Each week at roll call, Chris's name would be called. The next name on the list was always Buck. If Chris wasn't there, Buck wouldn't be there, but his name would still be called, and the rest of the fire department would wait, half expecting a bark. You see, Buck is Chris's dog. Chris Morrell is the oldest serving police canine handler in the country, and he and Buck have just retired from the Shelburne Police Department, where they served together since 2010. Before that, Morrell was chief of the Hinesburg Community Police Department for 16 years. Yesterday, as Buck sat under the table in our studio, Morrell explained that the dog goes everywhere he goes.
Pretty much everywhere. In fact, my previous dog and I went to the legislature to get the law passed that allows police dogs to be considered the same as service dogs. That was based on police officers that had gone different places in the state, and motel owners made them leave the dogs in the car.
Was that Doc, your previous canine?
Yes, it was.
You and Doc were entered into the Vermont Police Canine Handlers Hall of Fame. I understand you've had 5 canine partners?
That's correct.
Do you form a bond with those partners that is different than, I mean, I guess in some ways they're both coworkers and they're your pets. So what is the bond?
That is a very difficult thing to explain. Imagine, if you would, you had a child that was 7 years old that was developmentally challenged, and you were a single parent. And you took care of that child 24 hours a day, and you did everything together. How would you feel about sending that child into a lethal situation? And that's just the way most handlers feel about their dogs.
They feel that strongly about them?
Yes.
And you're no exception?
I'm probably the worst one.
You and Buck have been together for 10 years?
That's correct.
So he's retiring with you now?
Yes, we both retired 29th of June together.
Does he have the ability to just be a retired dog now?
To a certain extent, he mellows out. He becomes the dog he normally is at home. But the one thing you always have to watch, he's been trained to respond to what he perceives to be a threat to me, as you just saw when you tried to adjust the microphone in front of me and he gave you a little woof.
Mm-hmm. You've been a police officer for more than 4 decades, and for more than 3 decades, a canine handler. What made you want to go into that part of police work?
Well, hands down and going away, being a canine handler is the best job in police work. It sets you apart from many other police officers right from the very start. Humans have this funny perception. If you have a dog and he thinks you're okay, then you must be a good person. And, of course, we have a prayer that goes with that, and it's very simple. Oh, Lord, may I become half the man my dog thinks I am.
So you think dogs actually can help diffuse situations?
Absolutely. It breaks down the barriers immediately. Unfortunately, it's nothing that can be measured in, you know, number of incidents, number of arrests, which the bean counters always want. They're also a tremendous deterrent, which is another thing that can't be measured in numbers. But very often, because the dog's present, things come to a very peaceful conclusion. The last shift we worked, we had a young man who had threatened his family with an axe and had a knife and was going to commit suicide and so forth. And he ran off into the woods. And I began a track with Buck from where we found his shoes. And we went a little ways, and there was another officer standing right on the track. Buck went up to him, sat in what we call a revere, which is a guard position, and barked at him. I said, no, that's not the right one, Buck. Go back to the track. And he did. And we hadn't gone another 200 feet. Then the gentleman's mother's telephone rang, and he said he was coming out of the woods, and we immediately heard him moving. So we were right on top of him. Obviously, he heard that bark, and like most people, nobody wants to wrestle with a dog in the middle of the woods.
That's quite a shift to end on for your last police shift.
It was kind of a satisfying shift to end on.
Because the resolution was peaceful and positive?
Exactly. The dog did what he should. The whole thing was wrapped up. The young gentleman got the help he needed. Can't ask for much more than that.
What do police dogs do in Vermont? What are their main duties?
Well, most police dogs in Vermont are multifunction dogs. For example, if we have an intrusion alarm at, say, a big warehouse, the dog can search it much more quickly and efficiently than humans. If somebody runs from a burglary scene out into the woods, we can track them. If somebody's lost, we can do an area search and find them. If someone were to attack me, the dog is right there to be my backup. And we find sometimes dispatchers will assign a single canine unit to a call that normally they would assign two officers to. In addition, they're great detectors. Most patrol dogs detect either drugs or explosives.
Are canine officers today in Vermont doing more drug sniffing than they used to?
Yes, we're overrun with drugs in general.
Are they able to sniff out all different kinds of drugs?
There are a standard number of drugs that Vermont dogs are certified in. Marijuana, hash, cocaine, crack, heroin, meth, and ecstasy. And, of course, this doesn't equip us to deal with the new designer drugs where there's a different composition of compounds. And, in fact, the government in most places can't even adopt laws fast enough to keep up with these new designer drugs.
You were the first chief of the Hinesburg Community Police Department, and I understand you were responsible for putting the community in there. And you held that job for about 16 years. That relationship ended acrimoniously, but I'd love for you to reflect on when you started, because from what I've read, when you started, you were in a tiny office, you had no phone, you had no typewriter, you had no firearms, and you had no staff. So what was it like to be the police department?
Well, first off, I wasn't the first chief. Al Fortin was the first chief, and he's the one that got the department started.
Got it.
It was very interesting, and I have to hand it to the people that came after me, shortly after me, to the dedication they had that they could work under those conditions. They bought sirens for patrol cars. They bought the soap that we washed them with.
You mean out of their own pockets?
Yeah. It really was a group that wanted to get the job done, and they didn't stand on formality as far as, well, we've got to get the select board to pay for this. They just went out, did what had to be done to get the job done.
Why did you want the job? You came over from New York State.
There's something to be said about essentially starting a department and being able to develop it the way you want. I'm a big believer in community policing. And this was a chance to show that it really worked. And it did.
How do you distinguish community policing from other policing? What does that mean?
Well, I teach that at the academy. And defining community policing is very, very difficult. But it actually goes back to Robert Peel and the formation of the London Metropolitan Police back in the early 1800s. And those same principles apply to community policing. And one is that it's everyone's responsibility. The police are the only ones that get paid to devote full time to it. We encourage people to work with us in community policing. One other facet of it is the fact it's the way you treat people. You also have to treat the people that you're arresting very well and treat them fairly. And what's amazing is the response that you get. Now, you might wonder, now, why would you want to, you know, go out of your way to solicit the support of criminals? It's really very simple. We're in an information business, and they're the ones that have all the information. Father Miller down in Hinesburg was one of the nicest guys I ever met, but he was never able to give me any criminal information.
You have been lauded as the oldest canine handler in the country, but you're not that old. You're just 72, but you've been doing this for a long time.
That's true, and you have to understand there are other people in the canine world that are older than I am, but actually handling a dog is a little different story. And when you're working the 3 p.m. to 3 a.m. shift with a dog, there are very few people anywhere near my age doing that.
Well, Chris Morrell, congratulations on your retirement and best of luck to you and to Buck and to your family.
Well, thank you very much. I enjoyed it.
And does Buck speak? Can I say goodbye to him too? Will he say anything?
Yeah. Buck, could you wake up? Good boy. Give it out. Give it out. More. Give it out. Oh, okay.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Chris Morell and his German Shepherd canine companion Buck are going to be honored tonight at a casual celebration at the Hinesburg Public House starting at 7 o'clock. Four years ago, Jesus was all the rage. Now it's selfies. We're talking toasters, of course. Toasters that burn those images onto your favorite slice of bread. They're created by a company in St. Johnsbury called Vermont Novelty Toaster Corporation. And we have their CEO and president, Galen Dively, on the line with us right now. Hi, Galen. Welcome to Vermont Edition.
Hello. Thanks for having me.
So, I'm sorry, a selfie toaster?
Yes, a selfie toaster. It doesn't have to. A selfie is really something that you take a picture of yourself, but we get a lot of photographs that other people and professional photographs. We basically put any face on toast.
So what you're creating is a toaster that somebody sends their photo to you. You give them a toaster that can imprint their picture onto whatever toast they're slicing.
It will toast their photograph onto toast, yes.
You started this novelty toaster business 4 years ago. How is the selfie toaster doing compared to your other most famous toaster product, the Jesus toaster?
The selfie toaster really just took off last Thursday, and we're busy. And that's an understatement.
So what made it take off? I mean, this is not something that you came out with on Thursday. You've had it out there for a little while.
It's been out for a couple months. I guess it just hit the media. I did throw out some press releases, and it just hit the media just right, and it went viral, and we're very happy about it.
So who have you been talking to now in the press?
Oh, Lordy. We've been ABC, producers for ABC morning shows, just about quite a few shows across the country want their host to be on toast.
Where did this idea...
Do you want to?
No, I'm fine with myself not being on toast, because actually one of the questions I have for you is, what does toast from a selfie toaster taste like? Because I imagine it tastes like cannibalism.
No, it tastes like toast. It's caramelized bread.
How did you get this idea?
The idea came up from the fact that I really wanted to offer a toaster for businesses, for logos, and also to do my own imprints. Before I got my machine that cuts these plates, I had to actually pay quite a bit of money for each new design. So I got the machine, and it worked out great for me, and I had a photograph of my son, and I said, well, let me try this, and it came out great. So I decided to make a product out of it.
And it costs, about $80 for people to do this?
$75, and that includes shipping. And that's mainly because there is a lot of Photoshop work and there's a lot of CAD work to actually get it to the plate.
So how does that work? Can you explain the technology behind this? I mean, we all know what toast looks like and what happens when you put your bread into a toaster, but how do you actually make the imprint?
Well, we get the photograph, and I'll crop it, and I'll get the background out of it because the background's kind of noisy. And I... either through contrast and various filters, I turn that image into a stencil for all intents and purposes. And then I take that stencil and I put it in my CAD program, and it creates cut lines for our machine to cut it out of metal.
So what gets browned? Is it the face of the person that gets toasted, or is it the negative space or the positive space?
It's the negative space. It's very much like a silk screen. So, but instead of using ink going through the holes, you're using heat going through the holes.
So, Galen, why is it so important to you to hit on a successful idea like this and actually make some money from your selfie toasters and your Jesus toasters?
Well, I've got some very smart children getting ready to go to college.
And are you going to be able to send them to college on these toasters?
I sure hope so. I mean, my wife, she's a nurse here in Vermont, too, and we've been putting money away, but I hope so. I'll keep my fingers crossed.
You've been a tie-dye artist for 30 years, right?
Yes, I followed Grateful Dead around for 10 years selling my tie-dyes, and I've continued tie-dyeing ever since.
But tie-dyeing not as lucrative as the specialty toaster business?
It's not as lucrative, no, but it's fun.
What can we expect from you next? We've got the Jesus toaster, we've got the selfie toaster, you've got Poe toaster, Edgar Allan Poe. What's coming up next?
Well, we have a whole bunch. I'm really... not sure what's coming up next, but I do want to put something on my website that allows people to put their original art up. They buy the toaster and they let me sell it then, and then they can make a commission off of any toaster with their original art that gets sold.
All right. Well, we'll look forward to that. Galen Dively is the creator of the Vermont Novelty Toaster Corporation, which has been making waves around the world now with its new selfie toaster. We have a link at vpr.net. Galen, thanks so much for coming on the program.
You're so welcome. Thank you.
Well, that'll wrap it up for today's show. Tomorrow, we're going to end the week with a look at the economic well-being, education, and health of Vermont's children. A new study ranks Vermont second in the country in child well-being issues. We're going to look at what the state is doing well and the areas where it needs improvement. You can send your questions or comments regarding child well-being to Vermont Edition at vpr.net and then listen tomorrow at noon. Vermont Edition is produced by Patty Daniels, Rick Singeri, and Sage Van Wing, with production assistance from Catherine Hayes. Mary Williams directed the show, and our executive producer is John Van Hoosen. I'm Jane Lindholm. Thanks for listening.